HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 70, recorded Saturday, June 23rd, 2007. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. Support is also provided by Slash N Software Red Carpet Subscriptions, the most comprehensive solution for adding connectivity to your .NET and ASP.NET applications, with components for every major internet protocol. Online at www.nsoftware.com. And by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Tim Ferriss, best-selling author of The 4-Hour Workweek.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'm down here in Sebastopol, California at Foo Camp, and I've been lucky enough to sit down with Tim Ferriss, the New York best-selling author of The 4-Hour Workweek. That is 4, the number 4, not 40, not 14. 4-Hour Workweek. How's it going, Tim?
It's going great.
I want to understand how you're able to synthesize what is a 40 or 60 or 80 hour work week to those four or few hours that really are the most value added. I mean, are you just outsourcing everything that's tedious?
No, I think that that's the most popular topic to discuss because it gets people hot and heavy and it's political and emotional. But at the core, the most important concept is that of reductionism. And what I mean by that is it's very easy to make the simple complex, but it's quite challenging to make the complex simple. Once you identify the fewest moving parts, what you might call primitives in language learning, for example, that comprise the entire language or the entire objective. So in the case of work, if you do an 80-20 analysis of your inputs, you find that you'll find a very disproportionate ratio of input to output. So 20% of the activities that you're engaged in are generally correlated to 80% of the desired outcomes, but it's usually skewed even more than that. So what you find that this type of analysis ports very easily to almost any activity. So in the case of Tango, for example, I did my first Tango class in Argentina, and then 5 months later competed in the World Championships and made it to the semifinals representing Buenos Aires as an American, which has never been done. And then set a world record. And the reason I was able to do that is not because I mastered Tango in some amorphous, all-encompassing way. It's because I was able to identify that there were two components that really determined everything else, footwork and lead. And if I was able to learn those two things and really focus on refining those two things, that had my desired outcome. And so it's really looking at problems and realizing that the simplest solution is usually the best, a la Occam's razor, and really just trying to reduce it to these primitive elements.
And does that work in most everything? I mean, some people will say that the 80-20 rule basically makes you a person that's getting basically a B average. I mean, you're not truly excelling, but you're very competent. Can you take it to that next level?
I don't think that's true. I think it depends on how you measure competency, which is a separate discussion all in itself. But I think it's possible to be extremely world class in many, many things if you focus on what's important. And I believe that can be taught as well. So I think that the 80-20, the term 80-20 is misleading, because it can be 99-1, it can be 99-20. So what I mean by that is it doesn't need to add up to 100 either. So when people say, oh, 80%, well, then they think in terms of grade point average. But there's a point of diminishing returns with any activity. So, for example, in learning languages, and that's one of my various geek-out obsessions, you find that to be 95% accurate in a given language conversationally can be accomplished very quickly in about 6 months, 3 to 6 months, even with something like Mandarin Chinese or Japanese. But to get to, let's say, the 97% accuracy range could take 20, 25 years. And you find there's that same radical point of diminishing returns with almost anything, whether it's sports or business. So Putting in the first 2 hours of email may accomplish 99% of what you want versus putting in 20 hours of email, for example.
That's really, that just clicked for me. Now help me, this may be a silly tangent, but help me understand how that explains why those first 2-3 hours on any plane flight, I get more email done than at any session where I sit down consciously in my office and try to do my email.
I think one of the reasons is, and this may be more of a technical level, but Scoble said the same thing to me, coincidentally. And the reason is that you're focusing on output and exclusively output. So most people try to do both at the same time. So what happens? You have 50 email, you answer the first 5, and then ping, ping, you start getting replies. And that interrupts the function that you're trying to batch, which is that output. And then, of course, the other option or the other explanation is that if you're sitting in a fuselage hurtling through space in the window seat and you can't move, you don't have any crutch activities immediately within reach. So you can't go to the bathroom. You can't reorganize your file folders. You can't grab a cup of coffee and go talk to your colleague about something that's unimportant. You really have no crutch activity to resort to. So I think those two certainly contribute.
So then if I apply the analysis that we're talking about to trying to make that possible in my regular life when I'm not in an airplane, I unplug the network cable and sit in a simulated tube in my office and try to get that stuff handled.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you can simulate it. The way that I look at developing any skill set is you have sort of 3 layers of importance and that determine your results. The first is environment. So environment is the number one variable that you need to optimize. Secondly, you have the material, so the what of what you do. And then last, you have the method, all right, the how. And most people approach it in exactly the opposite order. So they focus on how to be very good at something before they determine whether it's important or not. Then they focus on doing that thing, and then they look at environment as an afterthought. And I approach it top down the other direction. So, for example, if I go to Berlin to learn German like I did, or if I go to Dubai to learn Arabic, which I'm going to do in 2 months or so, once my learning curve flattens out with this book, I'm going to disappear for a while. I will probably, in Dubai, for example, get an apartment that is fairly far outside the city. So what does that do? It immediately builds in probably 2-hour commute time. And I will learn Arabic in that commute time because I'm creating that fuselage type of isolation. But that's the way I learned Japanese. It's the way I learned Mandarin, almost all the languages that I've learned.
So it's literally setting yourself up for success.
Right, because humans have very poor impulse control, and they have very poor distraction filtering. So it's far more effective to create the proper environment that doesn't allow you to misbehave than to depend on making decisions about discipline at every point through the process.
So is this really effective single tasking? I mean, I'm hearing that there's a very conscious decision that this single task that I'm focusing on is the right thing. I noticed that we were in a talk earlier today. You were doing a hurdler stretch while you were listening to, and I said, well, maybe his secret is that he's multitasking.
No, I single task. The hurdler stretch doesn't require any mental RAM, so I'm able to do that. It's a passive activity, not an active activity. So you have different mental faculties that are consumed by different things, and you don't want to have specific mental applications, if I can really push the analogy, that are drawing on that same faculty. So you find when people try to answer email, I am. And do God knows what at the same time while eating a sandwich, it just doesn't work. It's calling on some of the same mental faculties, and you outstrip RAM quite quickly. And even if you have, so for example, we were talking about GTD before the interview, and what David Allen refers to as open loops. They also sit in the background like an application that just consumes RAM the entire time. So it is important to close those out as well.
Yeah, on previous podcasts, I've called that the psychic weight. Like, mm-hmm. I have a great deal of psychic weight just pulling me down because I know that when I get back to the hotel, I've got this crushing amount of email that needs to be caught up on. And it's all just every line item in Outlook is equally important just by virtue of the way it appears in Outlook.
Right.
I noticed when I emailed you to try to set up this interview, I got two things from you in the email. Immediately, I got an out-of-office reply, but not a typical one. It said, I check my email every 2 to 4 days because I'm trying to get work done, so bear with me. And then a few hours later, I got a very kind email from a woman named Amy, who lives God knows where, I don't know, another time zone somewhere.
Vancouver, Canada.
Vancouver, you outsourced to Vancouver, Canada. Mm-hmm. And she said, you know, this sounds like a very exciting thing. She CC'd your editor. Let's see if we can get on his schedule. She explained the situation. And while I initially thought, because I'd heard that you'd done this kind of outsourcing, and like, I don't mean to use the word outsourcing, maybe there's a better word.
No, it's fine. That works.
When I heard this, I said, well, gosh, am I that important to, you know, and I had a little kind of talk with myself. Should I do this? Is this valuable? Would people be insulted if I didn't answer their emails personally? But then at the same time, it did let me understand that, well, you know, Tim's got stuff to do. I better make my communications with this individual, so Amy, value added. So I ended up writing her an email that was more detailed and more specific in the amount of time it would save you when it eventually got down to you.
Well, that's why I recognized your name when you came up to me today. And I wouldn't recognize the names of the other 150 or 1,000 people that email me each day.
I'd never seen an assistant email like that. And it made, and she also included it at the bottom. She said, you know, Amy, executive assistant, this email is, she had checkboxes, bloggable, please ask, private. She checked please ask. And I thought that was fantastic because I never know when I email someone if it's going to show up copy-pasted flat out on their blog. I really thought that was impressive.
I have to give credit to Tom Faremski of Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley Watcher, I borrowed that from him, and then Amy liked it so much, I said, hey, you should use it too. I think it's a good idea, considering how much email will be coming in. So
do you end up, I assume she has access to your email, so then when you get to your box, there are specific action items for you to take.
I have multiple email accounts depending on their function. So I have a semi-public email account that goes to Amy. I have other business accounts for my separate businesses, which are primarily handled or at least filtered by other systems. And then I have my sort of personal email that I use for immediate action items that only I can attend to. And it's very clear what I have to do with them. And I've actually streamlined that further to the point where she no longer forwards email to me at all, which is very common. That is not common. What's most common is what I did initially with Amy, who manages other virtual assistants as well, who act on my behalf. So she's more of an operations manager, which was she would send the emails to me that she felt required my attention. And what I found was much more effective was simply getting on the phone with her once a day, and she would have I laid out a set of rules, essentially, for preparing for the call. And it's bang, bang, bang. I jumped on the phone with her today at 4 o'clock on the ride up here and handled all the email that I needed to handle, meaning I told her what she needed to do in about 4 minutes. I get more than 1,000 email a day.
This sounds like what we would, in the project management world, in the agile world, we call this a scrum. It's like a rugby scrum.
Okay.
We jump, every day we have a meeting. It's a stand-up meeting. We get together and we say, what are you working on? What did you do yesterday? What are you doing today? And what do I need to do to get that problem, whatever you're facing, out of the way?
Yep.
Anything else is peripheral, and if they last more than 15 minutes, you're doing it wrong.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It sounds like you're having a daily scrum with your operations team to find out, what do I need to do, and how can I empower you to do something on my behalf?
Sure. And the other thing that I do, and I talk about this in the 4-hour work week, but is I set certain guidelines, and I expect that I will have small problems I need to fix. I don't try to prevent every problem, because if you focus on trying to prevent every problem, you really can't take the proactive steps on the mission-critical tasks that you should be focusing your resources on. So, for example, I'm giving Amy increasing levels of decision-making ability with emails as she becomes familiar with my preferences. And I'm sure every once in a while something will slip through, but the alternative is hand-holding and checking every email that she reads, which would not only not save me time, but it would consume her time and consume my income.
You're actively trying not to be a micromanager. If you don't empower your subordinate, then why do you have a subordinate at all?
Right, and the way you empower them, though, is by providing extremely detailed, explicit rules. And It's not about saying you seem smart, make the right decision. There's a certain component of that, but it's very minimal, and it's supplemental to having extremely well-defined rules. So she has a file that is Tim Ferriss rules, and every time I send her an email, let's say she sends me an email and she asks, how should I respond to this? And I'll respond and I'll say new rule, and then I'll define exactly the principle that she can use to respond to these types of emails in the future. And she'll cut and paste that into this running document that she uses, and she also shares with her subordinate VAs, whom she manages. So it's very effective.
Is your full-time virtual assistant, or does she have other people that she works for?
She works for other people. Although I think she's probably working close to full-time with me at the moment, but I'm actively taking steps to cut down on the number of her hours. She's perfectly happy to work full-time because I'm paying her for that time, but I'm actively trying to and recruiting her help to cut down on the number of hours because it forces us to refine the rules. And ultimately, because right now she said, dude, I'm happy to put in X number of hours, which is a lot of hours. But I said, you know what? This is just the beginning. And from the outset, you have to ask yourself, can this system scale? So Amy's doing a great job right now. Fantastic. She's putting in 40 hours a week, but I'm getting 1,000 email a day. What happens when I'm getting 10,000 email a day? Okay. And then there are a lot of ways to solve that. I could simply take down all my email addresses, which I may do at one point. Simple fix. Done. Over. 5 minutes. But I'm at a point where I'm still gathering information from my readers so I can make improvements. And there'll be a point of diminishing returns with that. And when I hit that point, I'll remove my email.
Now, you're paying an employee 40 hours a week, and that for some of my listeners may be a little overwhelming. Wow, he's paying someone, but you're deriving value from more than you're paying her.
I'll put it this way. If people need to become very astute at calculating the value of their time. And you calculate the value of your time not only by your current income, but by what you could accomplish if you were able to create more time to focus on mission-critical tasks. So if I don't look at it as, let's just say hypothetically, I make $100,000 a year, that means I make $50 an hour. So if I pay her $25 an hour, that means I'm making $25 an hour. No, that's the starting point. But, for example, if I spend all my time doing email, I can't do anything else. And I'm miserable, so we didn't even get into that facet of the equation. But let's say instead I can spend 2 days focusing on an online educational module that then costs $99 per person, and I have a 5% conversion rate from every visitor to the site, and I get on national TV, and I drive that to X, Y, and Z, and then I'm making $150,000 a month. That pays for Amy very easily.
This is the thing I discovered a few years ago, which is that electrons are cheaper to sell than molecules.
Yes,
sell electrons all day long.
Cheaper to ship as well.
Now you have some interesting ideas around cash flow specifically. I understand that you have a passion for certain kinds of cars and things that someone might think are out of one's reach. When you look at it, rather than holistically over a 10-year, 20-year, 30-year period, and a month-to-month ins and outs can become attainable.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, you can get an Aston. I saw an Aston Martin DB9, which is a fantastic car, with 1,500 miles on eBay, which could be financed for less than, I'd say it was between $1,200 and $1,400 a month. I'll point this out. I don't have a DB9. I don't have a fast car. I drive a Volkswagen Golf because I'll tell you what's more important to me than owning a nice car is being able to park. Not being able to park, I live near San Francisco, infuriates me. So when I can't take the train, I want a small car. And secondly, I take it a step further. So ownership is of very little interest to me generally. So like Tyler Durden said in Fight Club, you know, what we own ends up owning us. And I believe that's true. I loathe maintenance of most things that consume energy and attention and don't provide, more value than they consume. So what does that mean? That means that when we look to buy, because that's the usual route, a nice car, Lamborghini, Ferrari, what we want is a certain experience. We need to define that experience. And then once we've defined that experience, there are much better ways of achieving it. So when I go to Dubai, I'm going to spend a day at a racetrack. And let's just say that I could afford to buy an Aston Martin Vanquish. Fantastic, great. But when I go to Dubai, and I'm in the process of arranging this, for less than $1,000 by using other currencies that I have, like credibility and association vis-a-vis the book, this is all, I've planned all this out. I will be able to race an Enzo Ferrari, an F1 McLaren, okay, $1.2 million car, one of Larry Ellison's toys, Lamborghini Murcielago, and a laundry list of other cars for an entire day for less than $500, including gasoline.
So because of the realization that it's, in fact, the experience that one wants more than it is the actual physical thing.
Absolutely. It's learning to value and define and then value intangibles, because ultimately I think that most things that we pursue are intangibles.
Yeah, I've traveled a lot as well, and I can tell you, obviously, from the languages, from the you value filling your life with experience, with travel, with language, with interactions with other people. You're probably a backpack traveler, and you probably don't check a lot of bags, I would guess.
No, actually, I'm going to be writing a blog post soon called "How to Travel the World and Contain Your Life in 10 Pounds." So.
That's awesome. You know, there's a lot of the super light hikers are always trying to squeeze a few ounces out of stuff, whether it be a water purifier that they can get in 3 ounces as opposed to 6 ounces. There's a big group of people on the internet that does that kind of stuff. I did Malaysia without checking a bag for 2 weeks, and I thought that was an achievement. But there's other guys that are pulling that kind of stuff off in a backpack.
Yeah, there's some very interesting approaches and tools out there. So I'll certainly be talking more about those on my blog in the upcoming weeks and months, especially once I start leaving myself. I'll need to, every once in a while, throw up a post, and they'll probably be travel-related.
So my brain is going 1,000 miles an hour. The only thing that I've successfully outsourced at this point is the mowing of my lawn. That was really easy. I pay him $20 an hour. I make more than that. It seemed like an obvious thing to do. But I'm realizing that I'm spending a lot of time answering email. I'm spending a lot of time not providing substantive value because I think I'm addicted to urgency. The classic kind of Covey urgency addiction, urgency versus importance. But, and I'm kind of getting some inspiration here, but I'm wondering, is this just simply that you are an incredibly willful individual and that you make the decision to do this and you make it so? Is this a series of techniques or is it a combination?
It's a series of conditioning, actually, more than techniques. So I can prescribe the medicine, but I can't force people to take it. And so you have a skill set and then you have behavior that allows someone to use that skill set. And behavior is usually limited by comfort with discomfort. So what does that mean? That means that each person has a comfortable sphere of action. And there are a certain number of options that they have given their sphere of comfort. And if you take small steps to increase that sphere of comfort, you increase the number of options you have. And it's a very convoluted way of saying that you need to condition yourself to making increasingly uncomfortable decisions and redefine risk. So when people talk about risk, I think they're actually talking about discomfort most of the time. When they say a risk of discomfort, so they say, oh, that's really risky. No, it's uncertain, therefore it's uncomfortable for you. And I define risk in 4-hour work week as the potential for an irreversible negative outcome. Okay, and when you look at risk that way, you find that very few things contain any risk, whether it's negotiating with a boss or implementing an autoresponder or outsourcing your email. You outsource your email, you try it for a day, it doesn't work, you cancel, you're back to where you were. Right? So there's a potential, let's say, negative outcome, temporary negative outcome on a scale of 1 to 10 of a 3 or a 4. Perhaps it doubles your workload for one day. Whereas a potential positive outcome that is semi-permanent could be a 9 or a 10. And once you start looking at decisions in those terms, and you make these small steps and take experiments, and I use the word experiment a lot because the only reason that I've been able to do some of the things that I've done, which appear outrageous, is that I've built up to them over time by conducting small experiments. Hence the name of the blog is Experiments in Lifestyle Design. Because almost all of these things are reversible.
Yeah, I like that, the experiments in lifestyle design. One of the things that struck me about the blog when I was poking around, I didn't expect to find pictures of before and after pictures of you working out. I'm a type 1 diabetic on an insulin pump, and I'm always trying to it sounds silly, but I'm always trying to gain weight because as a type 1 diabetic, we tend to just kind of drip weight off of us. And the way that you approach this pretty dramatic weight gain over a pretty short period of time was very, it felt very experimental. It felt like very scientific. It wasn't necessarily that you knew you were going to succeed, but you knew something was going to happen. You shook things up. You kept track of it at every point and made small adjustments as you went along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And I ended up gaining 34 pounds of muscle in 4 weeks. But what's more noteworthy than that is that I spent I had two workouts per week, each of 30 minutes or less. So what that means is I gained 34 pounds of muscle and lost 3 pounds of fat. So I recomposed my body entirely with 4 total hours of workout time in 1 month. And part of the reason I was able to do that is I harvest data compulsively. So every workout I've done for the last 6 years, I have recorded in detail. And so I can look, for example, at a photo of myself from 3 years ago, and I can see the exact date and say, I want to look exactly like I looked then. I can go back in my workout journal, repeat 4 weeks prior to that photo, and look exactly the same. And it's about the intelligent use of data. That's all it is. And I think that's something that anyone can duplicate. And you don't have to necessarily create that data yourself. You can borrow it from other people.
See, now that's huge. Now, at this point, some of my listeners may have said, well, what is this? This is not the typical Scott Hanselman podcast. It's usually about programming and development and stuff like this. But the idea that there is data out there, whether it be clickstream data, how people are moving around the web, the kind of stuff that my listeners do in their everyday job, whether it's blood sugar information that I'm storing because I've got all my blood sugar going back 12 years, I have a diet, I've got recipes. I have the same experience. I have blood tests going back 6 years, and I can look at diet and I can say, this is why my blood sugar was great for this 1 month period, or this is why it wasn't. And I can repeat those things.
Right.
I recently had I've been a type 1 diabetic for 12 years. I recently had my very first non-diabetic blood test where you could not tell if I was a type 1 diabetic. Now, to be clear, I'm on an insulin pump and it continues and I check my blood sugar 20 times a day and da 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 da. But on paper, on this one blood test, which is now up on my refrigerator with the number circled, I'm not a diabetic. So now I've got my success point. Mm-hmm. Now I just need to repeat that every month of my life until I'm dead.
Right. And I think that one important point to mention is that people who are very analytical and logical in one area of their lives, like programming, are very often completely neglectful of data in other areas. So you'll have someone who will sit down and clean up spaghetti code for 20 hours as just a logical machine, streamlining it. And then they'll go into the gym and they'll pick up the latest issue of Muscle and Fitness, which says, you know, how to turn your calves into cows on the cover. And they'll do 3 sets of 15 because the big guy taking steroids says do 3 sets of 15. But they never stop to ask themselves, why 3 sets and why 15? Why not 4 sets of 12? Why not 20 sets of 2? And the same logical tools, the critical thinking and lateral thinking tools that they apply in one area should be and can be applied in all of those areas.
This is very interesting. A lot of the programmers I know spend a lot of their analytical power analyzing two things, their financial life and their programming life. But very often they spend little time on things like diet, personal happiness, free time, you know, allocation of free time, what they ultimately want to do with their life, how they want to spend their time. You are working fewer hours a week. I assume you're filling the rest of your time with things that you enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And the challenge is taking something that's not obviously binary or numerical, like finance or programming, and converting it into numbers. That's all you have to do. That's the most time-consuming step. Once you do that, it's easy. I do spend my time doing things that either that I enjoy or that I derive benefit or fulfillment from. So I don't necessarily enjoy going to the kickboxing gym and getting punched in the head, but I find that the exercise, so to speak, the conditioning effect of that has a positive carryover to other areas. So I find it redeeming. I find it valuable. It may not be enjoyable in the laying on your stomach on a beach getting a massage sense of the word, but on some level it's valuable. And I think that if, once you take these very fuzzy qualitative terms that people don't stop to define, like success, happiness, and if you can't define them, you scrap them. It's a very simple solution. And I wanted to be a penciler, a comic book penciler, for about 10 years, and actually was an illustrator for a period of time, and had the same graphic editor position as Jim Lee did. Jim Lee used to be a very famous penciler. And one of the mandates or principles that a lot of pencilers use, and inkers in comic books, is when in doubt, black it out. And I think that if you apply that to most of your life, as opposed to trying to simply reorganize everything, you can get very, very far, very, very fast.
This is, I really appreciate you taking the time to sit down with me. The book is The 4-Hour Workweek, and the blog is also the4hourworkweek.com.
It's just either 4hourworkweek.com or the4hourworkweek.com, and then there's a link straight to the blog there.
Cool. Thanks a lot. And this has been another episode of Hansel Minutes. We'll see you again next week. Mm-hmm.